Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. On this edition of our show, we offer another installment in the popular Museum Confidential podcast series, which just posted its 100th episode. Museum Confidential is a co-production of Public Radio Tulsa and Philbrook Museum of Art, and you can find it wherever you get your podcast. Here on Studio Tulsa is the latest Museum Confidential.
Well, we did it. We've reached the last episode of Season 6. And if that weren't enough, it's our 100th show. That's right, 100. The Sopranos only had 86. Mad Men, 92. Sex and the City, a measly 94. Not to brag, but, well, okay, we'll brag a little. Over the past 6 seasons, we've talked to so many fascinating artists, museum professionals, critics, journalists, and a few people that defy any conventional description. We've explored the Museum of Bad Art and the world-famous Crochet Museum. We visited the High Museum with Killer Mike and talked trash with John Waters. We've hosted live shows in fancy places like Manhattan, New Orleans, and Denver. We teamed up with the Greenwood Art Project for a season on race and reconciliation timed with the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre Centennial. We had a spin-off season on Native women artists. We've talked about Me Too and sexual harassment, problematic histories, the gender disparity in museum collections, the pandemic, labor unions, and of course, money. And our most popular episode was a letter to a cat from a man in prison. It's been a wild ride, and you've been there listening all along. Thank you. And thanks to our dedicated sponsors, including but not limited to ladders, levels, non-reflective glass, black tape on the floor, and the phrase, "My kid could do that." Special shout out to our stalwart producer, Scott Gregory, and the entire team at Public Radio Tulsa. Can't wait to get going on Season 7. On today's show, we're doing a little bit of temperature taking with Samuel Redman, author of the fantastic and easily digestible new book, The Museum, A Short History of Crisis and Resilience. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is the 100th episode of Museum Confidential.
I know that you had the idea pre-COVID and we're kind of thinking about the book and looking at more of a historical, you know, how museums have survived and how they've been resilient. And then the book changed, of course, when the world changed with it, not just in terms of the virus, but in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, the social issues that we've been dealing with. Was it difficult to pivot like that, or did you ultimately see that as an opportunity for the book?
It's an interesting question. And I, to be honest, I had a great conversation with a potential publisher about this book, about what museums should be and the current and present state of museums. But I was really still mulling it over. And for anyone that's done any sort of research or writing project, sometimes when the world around you changes, that can help trigger a sort of new thought process. And when the pandemic ultimately came to North America and resulted in a huge number of closures, I, like many people, started thinking back to the 1918 influenza and started to become curious, like, well, how did that impact museums and the people who went to museums? And I was surprised that only a very few number of articles had been written on that. And when you go back and dive into the museum records and published reports and things that I could come across digitally. Obviously, I couldn't go into museums and libraries as much as I wanted to, but it was really remarkable what museums said at the time about the 1918 Spanish flu, but also the First World War and the widespread racial and labor unrest in that same era. And to be honest, sort of a good problem to have as a writer, once I started uncovering some of those really interesting stories, the book was almost writing itself.
So the kind of inciting incident that you look at here is this famous fire at the Smithsonian around the end of the Civil War period. And did you always know that that would be kind of the space you would jump off from? And also, when you learned about that, was that part of the idea for the book and kind of the idea, the seedling for the book?
Honestly, I didn't know. I had been thinking about museums and crisis moments for some time. I had written papers, essays as a PhD student at the University of California, Berkeley, on the Great Depression and museums and the Second World War and museums. So the concept of museum and crisis I'd been thinking about for some time and how to historicize some of those questions, you might say. But really, the new impetus for this was the crisis moment that we're in now. And I tried to think broadly, you know, sort of laying out a blank slate, like what are some of the episodes, crisis moments that I could look at and think about and try to go into it. I don't want to use the word objectively, of course, because we all have our own subjective biases and perspectives. But I did try to sort of blank slate it a little bit, like what are the key crisis moments for museums in the United States? And even though my book ended up being more about the 20th century and all the way up to the present day, it seemed like a really useful place to start, this incredible fire that happened at the Smithsonian around the time of the Civil War, and how in some ways that represented a really key turning point for the Smithsonian and museums in general in the United States.
So we're still in that period as relates to COVID that I think we're in that first draft of history period. We haven't had the benefit of hindsight to see. We're still very much in it. But, you know, a couple of years have passed and we can look back on some decisions that were made. When you look back to the 1918 period, you know, and having read books like John Barry's book, The Great Influenza, you can understand that period a little bit more. But there wasn't the level of societal closure that we saw here. Of course, there were mitigations put in place and, you know, the spread of that virus due to the lack of vaccine was much more widespread and a pretty horrific death toll globally. But you didn't see kind of the shutdown model that we use for this. That did affect museums much differently than that period would have. So do you have any insights on looking back, the kind of shutdown, the museum model ultimately was a bad decision? I mean, you never know in the moment, but what are your thoughts on that?
Sure. So there were a couple of things that, you know, there's an expression that historians sometimes use that history doesn't exactly repeat, but it sure does rhyme sometimes, that when looking back at this era that, you know, I was sort of writing this right as the drawdown in Afghanistan was also happening and thinking about the end of the First World War, in sort of a compare and contrast moment, the racial unrest that is happening. The summer of 1919 is an incredibly violent summer in cities across North America, and especially in the northern United States.
I think it was referred to maybe as Red Summer, perhaps.
Red Summer, right, where there's this white terroristic violence, especially against Black Americans, including some uniformed servicemen, quite ugly episodes. There's also a huge amount of labor unrest in that era. Often when we think about the 1920s, right, we think about the roaring 20s. We think about
the Gatsby, yeah.
Yeah. And, that certainly does come about. But by and large, it takes a couple of years into the 1920s for the economy to really recover. It's a different story in cities than it is in rural areas for a time. But museums, you know, there's so much going on. And honestly, that becomes one of the take-home points of the book. A key take-home point here is that it's almost never just one thing. That, you know, hurricanes are on the wake of financial crisis moments, that, you know, an epidemic is also taking place at a moment of racial reckoning, that hopefully if museum leaders are paying attention to this or people who care about museums, we should work to understand that it's the crisis moments are very rarely just one thing. So museums need to be resilient from a number of different directions in order to face that and be ready for change.
So any of the museums that have been around for 100 plus years, museums that have, you know, or longer, that have gone through all these social upheavals, whether it's the Depression or, you know, wars or anything else. They also were founded in problematic times and kind of have a legacy that they're going to have to deal with at some point. I think a lot of that has come to pass in the last couple of years, not just in relation to, say, George Floyd and everything post-George Floyd, but also a new look at colonialism, the impact of colonialism, which plays largely in museum collections and everything like that. So the survival that I'm talking about is not just the kind of physical survival or, you know, closing because of economics or anything like that, but how do you see kind of a, rather than a survival of the fittest moment, survival of the museums most willing to kind of look at themselves?
It's a great point and an excellent question, really elegantly stated, because I think that's totally one of the key take-home points here as well, is that museums suggest, by virtue of the fact that sometimes they occupy a century-old building or they have paintings that were created long ago that were acquired a century ago, there's sort of a suggestion of continuity there, or the sort of preservation model really stands out as being key in terms of the principles here. But as your question suggests, what it turns out to also be the case is that museums, a crisis, and let me just go back to the word crisis just for a second. I needed to, when thinking about this book, I this sounds sort of superficial, but it was revealing to look up the word crisis in the dictionary. And it turns out that a crisis moment is not just necessarily something on the path to doom. It is a key turning point or a crescendo in a story. So that crisis moment, then sort of rethinking that, is that these moments can be clarifying. They can be revealing in terms of certain truths. They can set about a new path. In 1990, when the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act passed, you could look back at newspapers and magazines and articles about museums from that time. And some people really paint this like doomsday scenario that's going to lead to the emptying out of museums and sort of this calamity sort of language. And I think if you talk to most reasonable minded people, they would say that that's pretty much the furthest thing of the truth, that many things have been returned and repatriated, but they certainly haven't emptied out museum collections. And if you look at it from a more optimistic perspective, they've actually made it so that museums needed to develop some better connections with indigenous communities, especially, and that can go much further. There's room for that to grow and go much further. But I can't help but see this as an opportunity, as well as being a potentially treacherous moment or series of treacherous moments for museums as well. We have to be realistic that sometimes these crisis moments, if handled poorly, can lead to even greater problems for museums.
I've been looking at the movie industry recently and trying to think about it in relation to museums, in the sense that I think it's very clear that we've gone through a bit of a paradigm shift, where the movie idea that you and I grew up in, that we would go to the movies a bunch of times a year and sit in a room with hundreds of people and experience something together, has very much changed. And I'm not sure 5 years from now, 10 years from now, how many traditional movie theaters there will be in cities, and at least not for things that we are accustomed to. And so you think about that and you're like, well, you know, if this is kind of the sunsetting of that idea, that had about 100-ish years of, you know, 115 years of, you know, lifespan. And I do wonder about everything in terms of cycles. And I think when you think about museums, do you feel that museums are ascendant still? Are they stable? Or do you feel that the concept of what museums have been for 100 years is at a point that has to either change or die, kind of thing? Where do you see that larger trend?
I sort of think all of the above in some ways is an answer. There's a story of what was at one time a major museum in Philadelphia called the Philadelphia Commercial Museum, that would display things about the business world and commerce and international trade. And that shut down. No, you know, very few people have heard of the Philadelphia Commercial Museum, right? That was sort of a blip on the radar. So it certainly can happen. There are other more recent examples of different museums either shutting down or being censured for actions like selling parts of the collection. I think museums are going to continually have to rethink themselves. And part of the story here is that museums in the 19th century were really focused on research, but also on this competition of trying to acquire the biggest and the best when, you know, Chicago is jostling for, influence against St. Louis and other cities. But the emphasis at some point had to change towards education. And so museums have evolved before, certainly, and I think they can continue to evolve. One aspect of the COVID reality is that museums had to, of course, take on or expand digital programs or digital initiatives that were already underway. And in the sort of surveys that have been done so far, the suggestion is that as museums continue to reopen, a number of visitors, the growing number of visitors will come from closer by, that people are sort of venturing back out into the world and they're maybe not going to museums quite as far away yet, but they're more interested in the museums that are around the block, maybe that they haven't visited in a couple months or certainly, you know, a couple years in many cases, right? So there's possibility there for museums to connect with younger audiences and audiences that are closer by. But certainly this has been a devastating time for museums. We'll just say it plainly that this has led to people being let go from jobs. It's led to, you know, this really difficult job market and housing market for many people. Museum staff remain underpaid in so many instances. Museum staff need to continue to diversify. This is part and parcel of a lot of great change that museums need to take on. And that does need to be some internal examination, but also listening to the outside voices that are asking or inviting museums to do better.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by carts. Yes, carts. Old paintings are often heavy, and those frames, though beautiful and gilded and ornate, do add some serious heft to these wondrous works. And let's be honest, people, museum workers aren't usually known for their deadlifting skills, but that's where carts come in. These handy little helpers make that trip from the prep shop to the gallery an absolute breeze. Remember, folks, you can't spell cart without art.
So I was intrigued by, you know, you mentioned you had to kind of explore the origin of the word crisis, and, you know, the origin of the word museum is something akin to like seat of the muses, a place where the muses, you know, gather. And muses, of course, are sources of inspiration. And if you think about the future of museums as a place where you are inspired rather than, I think we've kind of trained people to think of it as a high-end storage facility or a cabinet of curiosities or something like that. It's just a place where old stuff is kept a lot of times. But if you think about it as a place that's a place you go to find your muse, to get inspired, to me, that has lots of opportunity with it.
Absolutely. And part of the critical examination here has been, as certainly in recent years, there was a trend towards major blockbuster exhibitions. And you know, one wonders that the advantage of that is getting people in the door, you know, inviting people in, come see the Lego Star Wars exhibit. I don't mean to tease about the Lego Star Wars exhibit because I have a kid right now who's in the core demographic for that. That would attract us to an exhibit for you know, a museum for sure. But it you know, there also is a huge number of collections and stories inside of museums that haven't necessarily been told or brought forward. So it would be great to see, you know, maybe less of an emphasis on, you know, creating this large carbon footprint for these massive traveling exhibitions and focusing on local communities and stories that are held within these institutions. But like you say, I think that part of the story needs to be inspiring people, opening the doors to tell other stories and ask different questions. But then also, too, museums are seen as fairly trusted sites that surveys suggest that in this world of fake news and fact checking and things like that, that museums are still considered fairly trusted sources, you know, in an era where people are questioning a lot of authority and science. So as a public health problem, as a social problem, as a civic problem, I think it's important to embrace that and value that and build that trust through exhibits that answer people's core questions and that teach people sometimes hard truths, but also honest truths. And then in some places, you know, some stories need to be celebrated and uplifted. And some communities are really ready for challenging stories, but there also needs to be, you know, exhibitions that look for joy and look at other sides of life too.
Yeah, you know, one of the ways we think about the kind of the issue of the blockbuster and something we talk about a lot is, you know, there is a true value to kind of monoculture because it does have the rare opportunity of bringing people together and other things. We always think like, well, if you're going to host a blockbuster exhibition, what are you going to do with the rest of your museum while you have a captive audience? How are you going to use that as an entry point to show them other parts of your collection, tell different stories? Because it is an opportunity to get people through the door that might not be coming in regularly. But if you're not using it as a tool to expand someone's interest, it's not, I kind of think it's like, you know, it's the salacious headline on the newspaper, but you need them to read the deeper story about what the city council is doing on page six, you know.
Agreed.
So I'm curious, having gone through this project, which is a long, you know, project and culmination of a lot of work you've done, did you go into it with a more of a Chicken Little mentality and then leave it feeling more optimistic? Did the process change the way you thought about the future or even the present of museums?
I think so. I think that there is some room to be optimistic, that museums have been setting attendance records. There are a growing number of museums globally, that conversations have been opening up, really significant conversations have been opening up about repatriation and restitution globally that I think are really important. And I think that there's been hard conversations about the use and abuse in many cases of collections related to Black Americans in the last several years that I think have been really important. There are also some things that museums need to worry about, I think, legitimately, in terms of both looking at the history and the present state of museums. Again, I think the most important resource that a museum has in almost every case is its staff, that staff care deeply on all levels. If you look at episodes of crisis like Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Katrina, and the wildfires recently in California, again and again, maintenance staff, people who are working in custodial services, people at the front of house are responsible for in some cases, saving these incredible collections. So one of the things that I advocate for is that there are these incredible Mellon-funded workshops for museum staffers that they can take workshops in disaster planning and disaster response. But I think those should be available to all museum staff and that those should be freely given to museum staff on all levels, because in order to make museums more resilient, when an all-encompassing disaster like an earthquake or a wildfire or a flood happens, you need to think about it on all levels. You need to think about it in terms of the building, in terms of the collections management, curation, but also people. How are we going to take care of these individuals and get them out of a potentially dangerous area? Museum staff have really gone above and beyond in the last few years in terms of those crisis moments.
I'd like to finish up by talking about threats to museums. So we've talked about fires, we've talked about wars, we've talked about global pandemics. My assumption and my thought and my theory is that the biggest threat to museums is attention, and that something like Netflix or TikTok is as big of a threat to the future of how we think about museums than any of the things I mentioned prior to that. I'm just curious to hear your take on the attention economy and how that will impact museums.
Sure. So maybe it's that historians are really bad at making predictions. But one of the things that I found, that extends to museum professionals, is in terms of revisiting some of these episodes of crisis and just, you know, even doing searches and databases of where people have used the words museum and crisis linked together, we're not terribly good at predicting what the next crisis really around the corner would be. If you go back to, say, the year 2000, a lot of people worried about instances of terrorism, instances of global terrorism, or certainly in the wake of 9/11, but also the Oklahoma City bombing. Museums in Oklahoma were trying to decide, like, when is the right time to reopen to the public following that. Washington, D.C., again, after the September 11th terror attacks, And, you know, it turns out, yes, there were attacks at the Louvre and globally around the world that have impacted museums and their visitors. But that ended up being a much less of a threat, I would argue, than, say, climate change, which ended up being this thing that, you know, museums have had to think about in terms of caring for their collections, in terms of their facilities, and so much more. So it's difficult to predict, like, what the next, you know, challenges will be. And one more anecdote that came out while thinking about this book, a curator from the SF MoMA talked about seeing the first CD-ROM of the museum collection and hearing some people at the meeting being like, wow, this is it. This is, you know, this is where the museum ends, because now people will be able to look at these things digitally. And of course, pretty much the exact opposite happens, right? That if you learn about a collection online, you're more likely to go visit it in person rather than be like, oh, I'm satisfied. I've seen a picture of that painting on my computer. So hopefully there are opportunities in venues like TikTok and elsewhere to, again, attract curiosity, to introduce people, to inspire people, to sort of give some of that nugget of learning and draw them in deeper. I think it'll remain to be seen. Museums do need to lean into some of these challenges and respond directly rather than run away from them. But if they do, I think they have the chance to continue to be resilient for the next 100 years.
We spoke in the interview briefly about the Smithsonian Fire of 1865. It happened on January 24th. A bit later, of course, in April, Lee would surrender to Grant, and then Lincoln would be assassinated. After the fire at the Smithsonian occurred, it was found that the blaze had been triggered by a stove that was incorrectly installed in the picture gallery on the museum's second floor. The damage to the collection and the building was described by the New York Times as, quote, a national calamity. Joseph Henry, the first secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, had been, back in the 1830s, a pioneer in the fields of electricity and electromagnetism. He was instrumental in the invention and development of the telegraph, the electric motor, and the telephone. Henry's office was destroyed in the fire at the Smithsonian, but a few things did remain, including a telegraph. Unfortunately, in 1865, there was no such thing as 911. Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.